to reach the building. He emerged from a nearby street and ran up the steps with two huge strides, then turned and roared at the 30 soldiers following him. Seeing the cull safe among friends, the soldiers wisely dropped back.
"Strong hammer," exclaimed Gajvarg. "You asked, and I have come."
After a few more minutes, the others Roran had sent the herbalist to fetch arrived at the great stone building. The silver-haired elf, who presented himself, was one Roran had seen with Island Zardi on several occasions. Lord Dathader was his name. The six of them, all bloody and weary, stood in a clump among the fluted pillars. "I have a plan to kill Bast," Roran said. "But I need your help, and we have little time. Can I count on you?"
"That depends on your plan," said Oric. "Tell it to us first."
So Roran explained it as quickly as he could. When he finished, he asked Oric, "Can your engineers aim the catapults and ballistae as accurately as needed?" The dwarf made a noise in his throat.
"Not with how humans build their war machines. We can put a stone within 20 feet of the target, but any closer than that is up to luck."
Roran looked at the elf lord, Dathader. "Will the others of your kind follow you?"
"They will obey my orders, Stronghammer. Do not doubt it."
"Then will you send some of your magicians to accompany the dwarves and help guide the stones?"
"There would be no guarantee of success. The spells might easily fail or go astray."
"We'll have to risk it." Roran swept his gaze over the group. "So I ask again, can I count on you?" Out by the city wall, a chorus of fresh screams erupted as Bast smashed his way through a bank of men. Gajvarg surprised Roran by being the first to answer.
"You are battle mad, Stronghammer, but I will follow you," he said.
He made a ruck-ruck sound that Roran thought might be laughter.
"There will be much glory in killing Bast."
Then Jormungandr said, "Aye, I'll follow you as well, Roran. We have no other choice, I think."
"Agreed,"
said Oric.
"Agreed,"
said Grimur, king of the Weircats, drawing the word out into a throaty growl.
"Agreed," said Lord Dathader.
"Then go," said Roran. "You know what you need to do. Go!" As the others departed, Roran called his warriors together and told them his plan. Then they hunkered between the pillars and waited. It took 3 or 4 minutes, precious time, in which Bast and his soldiers pushed the Varden ever closer to the breach in the outer wall. But then Roran saw groups of dwarves and elves run up to 12 of the nearest ballistae and catapults on the walls, and free them from the soldiers. Several more tense minutes passed. Then Oric hurried up the steps to the building, along with 30 of his dwarves, and said to Roran,
"They're ready."
Roran nodded. To everyone with him, he said, "Take your places." The remnants of Roran's battalion formed a dense wedge, with him at the tip, and the elves and Urgals directly behind him. Oric and his dwarves took up the rear. Once all of the warriors were in place, Roran shouted, "Forward!" and trotted down the steps into the midst of the enemy soldiers, knowing that the rest of the group was close behind him. The soldiers had not been expecting the charge. They parted before Roran like water before the prow of a ship. One man tried to bar Roran's way, and Roran stabbed him through the eye without breaking stride. When they were about 50 feet from Bast, who had his back turned, Roran stopped, as did the warriors behind him. To one of the elves, he said, "Make it so everyone in the square can hear me." The elf muttered in the ancient language, then said,
"It is done."
"Bast!" shouted Roran, and was relieved to hear his voice echo over the whole of the battle. The fighting throughout the streets came to a halt, save for a few individual skirmishes here and there. Sweat dripped down Roran's brow, and his heart was pounding, but he refused to feel afraid. Burst! He shouted again, and slapped the front of his shield with his spear. Turn and fight me, you maggot-ridden cur! A soldier ran at him. Roran blocked his sword, and in one easy motion swept the man off his feet and dispatched him with two quick jabs. Pulling his spear free, Roran repeated his call. Burst! The broad, heavy figure slowly turned to face him. Now that he was closer, Roran could see the sly intelligence that lay in Bast's eyes, and the small, mocking smile that lifted the corners of his childlike mouth. His neck was as thick as Roran's thigh, and beneath his mail hauberk, his arms were knotted with muscles. The reflections from his protruding breastplate kept snaring Roran's gaze, despite his efforts to ignore them. Bast! My name is Roran Stronghammer, cousin to Aragorn Shadeslayer. Fight me if you dare, or be branded a coward before all here today.
No man scares me, Stronghammer. Or should I say Lackhammer? For I see no hammer upon you.
Roran drew himself up.
I need no hammer to kill you, you beardless bootlicker. Is that so?
Bast's tiny smile grew wider.
Give us room,
he shouted, and waved his mace at the soldiers and Vardon alike. With the soft thunder of thousands of feet treading backward, the armies withdrew, and a wide circular area formed around Bast. He pointed his mace at Roran.
Galbatorix told me of you, Lackhammer. He said I was to break every bone in your body before I killed you. What if we break your bones instead? Said Roran.
Now! He thought as hard as he could, trying to shout his thoughts into the darkness that surrounded his mind. He hoped the elves and the other spellcasters were listening as promised. Bast frowned and opened his mouth. Before he could speak, a low whistling noise sounded over the city, and six stone projectiles, each the size of a barrel, hurtled over the tops of the houses from catapults on the walls. A half-dozen javelins accompanied the stones. Five of the stones landed directly on Bast. The sixth missed and went bouncing across the square like a rock across water, bowling over men and dwarves alike. The stones cracked and exploded as they struck Bast's wards, sending fragments flying in every direction. Roran ducked behind his shield and nearly fell as a fist-sized chunk of stone slammed into it, bruising his arm. The javelins vanished in a flare of yellow fire, which gave a ghoulish light to the clouds of dust that floated upward from Bast's location. When he was sure it was safe, Roran looked over his shield. Bast was lying on his back amid the rubble, his mace on the ground next to him.
Get him!
Roran bellowed and ran forward. Many of the gathered Varden started toward Bast, but the soldiers they had been fighting shouted and attacked, stopping them from covering more than a few steps. With a roar, the two armies turned on each other once again, both factions inflamed with a desperate anger. As they did, Jormungandr emerged from a side street, leading 100 men whom he had collected from the edges of the battle. He and those with him would help hold back the scrum of combatants while Roran and the others dealt with Bast. From the opposite side of the square, Garjvarg and six other Karl charged out from behind the houses they had been using for cover. Their pounding footsteps shook the ground, and men of both the Empire and the Varden scrambled to move out of their way. Then hundreds of werecats, most in their animal forms, slipped out from the main body of the intermingled armies and streamed across the cobblestones, teeth bared, toward where Bast lay. Bast had just begun to stir when Roran reached him. Grabbing his spear with both hands, Roran brought it down on Bast's neck. The blade of the weapon stopped a foot away, and the tip bent and snapped as if it had struck a block of granite. Roran cursed and continued to stab as quickly as he could, trying to keep the Eldunari within Bast's breastplate
from recovering its strength. Bast groaned.
Hooray! Roran bellowed at the Urgles.
Once they were close enough, Roran sprang aside so that the Kull would have the room they needed. Taking turns, each of the massive Urgles struck at Bast with their weapons. His wards blocked them, but the Kull continued to hammer away. The sound was deafening. Weercats and elves gathered around Roran. Behind them, he was half aware of the warriors he had brought with him, holding off the soldiers, along with Jormungandr's men. Just when Roran was beginning to think that Bast's wards would never give way, one of the Kull uttered a triumphant shout, and Roran saw the creature's axe glance off the front of Bast's armor, denting it.
Again! Roran shouted. Now! Kill him!
The Kull lifted his axe out of the way, and Garjvarg swung his iron-bound club toward Bast's head. Roran saw a flurry of motion, and then there was a loud thud as the club struck Bast's shield, which the man had pulled over himself.
Blast it!
Before the Urgles could attack again, Bast rolled up against the legs of one of the Kull, and his hand latched onto the back of the Kull's right knee. The Kull bellowed with pain and hopped backward, pulling Bast out of the knot of Kull. The Urgles and two elves closed in around Bast once more, and for a number of heartbeats it seemed as if they might subdue him. Then one of the elves went flying, her neck crooked at an odd angle. A Kull fell onto his side, shouting in his native language. Bone protruded from his left forearm. Garjvarg snarled and jumped back, blood streaming from a fist-sized hole in his side.
No, thought Roran, going cold. It can't end like this. I won't let it.
Shouting, he ran forward and slipped between two of the giant Urgles. He barely had time to see Bast, bloody and enraged, with his shield in one hand and a sword in the other, before Bast swung his shield and struck Roran on the left side of his body. The air rushed out of Roran's lungs, and the sky and the ground spun around him, and he felt his helmet-covered head bouncing against the cobblestones. The world seemed to keep moving beneath him, even when he rolled to a stop. He lay where he was for a time, struggling to breathe. At last he was able to fill his lungs with air, and he thought he had never been so grateful for anything as he was for that breath. He gasped. Then he howled as his body filled with pain. His left arm felt numb, but every other muscle and sinew burned with agony. He tried to push himself upright and fell back onto his stomach, too dizzy and hurt to stand. Before him was a fragment of yellowish stone, veined with coiled branches of red agate. He stared at it for a while, panting, and the whole time the only thought running through his mind was,
"Have to get up! Have to get up! Have to get up!"
When he felt ready, he tried again. His left arm refused to work, so he was forced to rely on his right alone. Hard as it was, he got his legs underneath him, and then he slowly rose to his feet, shaking and unable to take more than shallow breaths. As he straightened, something pulled in his left shoulder, and he uttered a silent scream. It felt as if a red-hot knife was buried in the joint. Looking down, he saw that his arm was dislocated. Of his shield, nothing remained but a splintered board still attached to the strap around his forearm. Roran turned, searching for Bast, and saw the man 30 yards away, covered in clawing weercats. Satisfied that Bast would be occupied for at least a few more seconds, Roran returned his gaze to his dislocated arm. At first, he could not remember what his mother had taught him, but then her words returned to him, faint and blurred by the passage of time. He pulled off the remnants of his shield.
"Make a fist," mumbled Roran, and he did so with his left hand. "Bend your arm, so your fist points forward."
That he did, though it worsened his pain.
"Then turn your arm outward, away from you."
He screamed a curse as his shoulder grated, the muscles and tendons pulling in ways they were not supposed to stretch. He kept turning his arm, and he kept clenching his fist. And after a few seconds, the bone popped back into the socket. His relief was immediate. He still hurt elsewhere, especially his lower back and ribs, but at least he could use his arm again, and the pain was not so excruciating. Then Roran looked toward Bast again. What he saw sickened him. Bast was standing in a circle of dead weercats. Blood streaked his dented breastplate, and clumps of fur clung to his mace, which he had retrieved. His cheeks were scratched deeply, and the right sleeve of his mail hauberk was torn, but otherwise he appeared unharmed. The few weercats who still faced him were careful to keep their distance, and it looked to Roran as if they were about to turn tail and run. Behind Bast lay the bodies of the Kull and the elves he had been fighting. All of Roran's warriors seemed to have disappeared, for none but soldiers surrounded Roran, Bast, and the weercats, a seething mass of crimson tunics, the men pushing and shoving as they struggled against the eddies of the battle.
"Shoot him!"
Roran shouted, but no one seemed to hear. Bast noticed, however, and he began to lumber toward Roran.
"Blackhammer!" he roared. "I'll have your head for this!"
Roran saw a spear on the ground. He knelt and picked it up. The motion made him light-headed.
"Let's see you try,"
he replied. But the words sounded hollow, and his mind filled with thoughts of Katrina and their child who was yet to be. Then one of the weercats, who was in the form of a white-haired woman no taller than Roran's elbow, ran forward and cut Bast along the side of his left thigh. Bast snarled and twisted, but the weercat was already retreating, hissing at him while she did. A moment more Bast waited, to ensure that she would not trouble him again, and then he continued walking toward Roran, limping now as his new wound exacerbated the hitch in his stride. Blood sheeted down his leg. Roran wet his lips, unable to look away from his approaching foe. He had only the spear, he had no shield, he could not outrun Bast, and he could not hope to match Bast's unnatural strength or speed. Nor was there anyone nearby to help him. It was an impossible situation, but Roran refused to admit defeat. He had given up once before, and he would never do so again, even though reason told him that he was about to die. Then Bast was upon him, and Roran stabbed at his right knee in the desperate hope that he might by some chance cripple him. Bast deflected the spear with his mace, then swung at Roran. Roran had anticipated the counterattack, and was already stumbling backward as fast as his legs would allow. A gust of wind touched his face as the head of the mace swept past, inches from his skin. Bast showed his teeth in a grim smile, and he was about to strike again, when a shadow fell on him from above, and he looked up. Islanzadi's white raven dropped out of the sky and landed on Bast's face. The raven screeched with fury as it pecked and clawed at Bast, and Roran was astonished to hear the raven say, "Die! Die! Die!" Bast swore and dropped his shield. With his free hand, he batted the raven away, breaking its already injured wing. Ribbons of flesh hung loose from his brow, and blood painted his cheeks and chin crimson. Roran lunged forward and stabbed Bast's other hand with his spear, causing Bast to drop his mace as well. Then Roran seized his chance and stabbed at Bast's exposed throat. However, Bast caught the spear with one hand, tore it from Roran's grip, and broke it between his fingers as easily as Roran might break a dry twig.
"Now you die," said Bast, spitting blood.
His lips were torn and his right eye was ruined, but he could still see out of his remaining orb. The man reached for Roran, seeking to envelop him in a deadly embrace. Roran could not have escaped even if he had wanted to. But as Bast's arms closed about him, Roran grasped Bast's waist and twisted with all his might, putting as much weight and pressure as he could on Bast's wounded leg, the leg with the hitch. Bast held for a moment, then his knee buckled, and with a cry of pain he fell forward onto one leg and caught himself with his left hand. Squirming around, Roran slipped out from under Bast's right arm. The blood on Bast's breastplate made it that much easier to work free, despite the man's immense strength. Roran tried to grab Bast's throat from behind, but Bast tucked his chin, preventing Roran from getting a grip. So instead, Roran wrapped his arms around Bast's chest, hoping to restrain him until someone else could help kill him. Bast growled and threw himself onto his side, jarring Roran's injured shoulder and causing him to grunt with pain. The cobblestones dug into Roran's arms and back as Bast rolled three times. When the bulk of the man was atop him, Roran had trouble breathing. Yet still, Roran maintained his grip. One of Bast's elbows slammed into his side, and Roran felt several of his ribs break. Roran clenched his teeth and tightened his arms, squeezing as hard as he could.
"Katrina," he thought.
Again, Bast's elbow slammed into him. Roran howled, and flashing lights appeared before his eyes. He squeezed even harder. Again, the elbow, like an anvil, pounding into his side.
"You shall not win, Lackhammer," grunted Bast.
He staggered to his feet, dragging Roran with him. Though he thought he might tear the muscles from his bones, Roran tightened his embrace even further. He screamed, but he could not hear his voice, and he felt veins pop and tendons snap. And then Bast's breastplate caved in, giving way where the cull had dented it, and there was the sound of crystal breaking.
"No!"
shouted Bast, even as a pure white light erupted from the edges of his armor. He went rigid, as if chains had pulled every limb to its farthest reach, and he began to shake uncontrollably. The light blinded Roran and burned his arms and face. He released Bast and fell to the ground, where he covered his eyes with his forearm. The light continued to pour out from under Bast's breastplate until the edges of the metal began to glow. Then the blaze ceased, leaving the world darker than before, and what little remained of Lord Bast tumbled backward and lay smoking on the cobblestones. Roran blinked as he stared at the featureless sky. He knew he should rise, for there were soldiers nearby, but the cobblestones seemed soft beneath him, and all he really wanted to do was to close his eyes and rest. When he next opened his eyes, he saw Oric and Horst and a number of elves gathered around him.
"Roran, can you hear me?"
said Horst, peering at him with concern. Roran tried to speak, but he could not form the words.
"Can you hear me? Listen to me. You have to stay awake. Roran! Roran!"
Again, Roran felt himself sinking into blackness. It was a comforting sensation, like wrapping himself in a soft woolen blanket. Warmth spread through him, and the last thing he remembered was Oric bending over him and saying something in Dwarvish that sounded like a prayer. The Gift of Knowledge. Eyes locked, Aragorn and Murtagh slowly circled each other, trying to anticipate where and how the other would move. Murtagh appeared fit as ever, but there were dark circles under his eyes, and his face was haggard. Aragorn suspected that he had been under a great strain. He wore the same pieces of armor as did Aragorn, mail hauberk, gauntlets, braces, and greaves, but his shield was longer and thinner than Aragorn's. As for their swords, Brisinger, with its hand and a half hilt, had the advantage of length, while Zarok, with its wider blade, had the advantage of weight. They began to edge closer, and when they were about 10 feet apart, Murtagh, who had his back to Galbatorix, said in a low, anger-filled voice,
"What are you doing?"
"Buying time," Aragorn muttered, keeping his lips as still as possible. Murtagh scowled.
"You're a fool. He'll watch us cut each other to shreds, and what will it change? Nothing.
Instead of answering, Aragorn shifted his weight forward and twitched his sword arm, causing Murtagh to flinch in response.
Blast you, growled Murtagh. If you had waited just one more day, I could have freed Nasawada.
That surprised Aragorn.
Why should I believe you?
The question angered Murtagh further, for his lip curled and he quickened his step, causing Aragorn to increase his pace as well. Then in a louder tone, Murtagh said,
So you finally found a proper sword for yourself. The elves made it for you, didn't they?
You know they did.
Murtagh lunged toward him, swinging Zarok at his gut, and Aragorn skipped backward, barely parrying the red sword. Aragorn replied with a looping overhead blow. He allowed his hand to slide down to Brisinga's pommel to give himself more reach, and Murtagh danced out of the way. They both paused to see if the other would attack again. When neither did, they resumed circling, Aragorn more wary than before. From their exchange, it was obvious that Murtagh was still as fast and as strong as Aragorn, or an elf. Galbatorix's prohibition on the use of magic apparently did not extend to the spells that fortified Murtagh's limbs. For selfish reasons, Aragorn disliked the king's edict. But he could understand the rationale behind it. The fight would hardly have been fair otherwise. But Aragorn did not want a fair fight. He wanted to control the course of the duel, so that he could decide when it should end, and how. Unfortunately, Aragorn doubted that he would have the opportunity, given Murtagh's skill with a blade. And even if he did, he was not sure how he could use the fight to strike against Galbatorix. Nor did he have time to think about it, though he trusted that Saphira, Arya, and the dragons would try to devise a solution for him. Murtagh fainted with his left shoulder, and Aragorn ducked behind his shield. An instant later, he realized that it had been a ruse, and that Murtagh was moving around toward his right in an attempt to get past his guard. Aragorn twisted and saw Zarok arcing toward his neck, the edge a glittering wire-thin line. He knocked it aside with a clumsy push of Brisinga's crossguard. Then he retaliated with a quick slash at Murtagh's lower arm. To his grim delight, he struck Murtagh on the side of his wrist. Brisinga failed to cut through Murtagh's gauntlet and the sleeve of the tunic beneath. But the impact still hurt Murtagh and pushed his arm away from his body, leaving his chest exposed. Aragorn stabbed, and Murtagh used his shield to deflect the attack. Three more times Aragorn stabbed, but Murtagh stopped each blow. And when Aragorn drew back his arm to strike again, Murtagh countered with a backhanded cut at his knee, which would have crippled him had it landed. Seeing what Murtagh intended, Aragorn altered his swing and stopped Zarok an inch from his leg. Then he countered with a cut of his own. For several minutes they exchanged blows, trying to disrupt each other's rhythms, but to no avail. They knew each other too well. Whatever Aragorn attempted, Murtagh was able to thwart, and the same was true in reverse. It was like a game where they both had to think many moves in advance, which fostered a certain sense of intimacy as Aragorn focused on divining the inner workings of Murtagh's mind, and from them, predicting what Murtagh would do next. Right from the beginning, Aragorn noticed that Murtagh was playing the game differently than the previous times they'd fought. He attacked with a ruthlessness that heretofore had been lacking, as if for the first time he wanted to defeat Aragorn, and quickly too. Moreover, after his initial outburst, his anger seemed to vanish, and he displayed only a cool, implacable determination. Aragorn found himself fighting to the limit of his abilities, and though he was able to hold Murtagh off, he ended up on the defensive more than he would have liked. After a while, Murtagh lowered his sword and turned toward the throne and Galbatorix. Aragorn kept his guard up, but he hesitated, unsure whether it was appropriate to attack. In that moment of hesitation, Murtagh leaped toward him. Aragorn stood his ground and swung. Murtagh caught the blow on his shield, and then instead of following up with a strike of his own, as Aragorn expected, he slammed his shield against Aragorn's and pushed. Aragorn growled and pushed back. He would have reached around his shield to slash at Murtagh's back or legs, but Murtagh was shoving too hard for Aragorn to risk it. Murtagh was an inch or two taller, and the extra height allowed him to bear down on Aragorn's shield
in a way that made it difficult for Aragorn to keep from sliding back across the polished stone floor. At last, with a roar and a mighty heave, Murtagh sent Aragorn stumbling away. As Aragorn flailed and struggled to regain his balance, Murtagh stabbed at his neck.
"Let her," said Galbatorix.
The tip of Zarok stopped less than a finger's breadth from Aragorn's skin. He froze, panting, not sure what had just happened.
"Restrain yourself, Murtagh, or I shall do it for you," said Galbatorix from where he sat watching. "I dislike having to repeat myself. You are not to kill Aragorn, nor is he to kill you. Now, continue."
The realization that Murtagh had just tried to kill him, and that he would have succeeded if not for Galbatorix's intervention, shocked Aragorn. He searched Murtagh's face for an explanation, but Murtagh remained stubbornly expressionless, as if Aragorn meant little or nothing to him. Aragorn could not understand. Murtagh was definitely playing the game differently than he ought to be. Something had changed in him, but what it was, Aragorn could not tell. In addition, the knowledge that he had lost, and that by all rights he should be dead, undermined Aragorn's confidence. He had confronted death many times before, but never in such a stark and uncompromising manner. There was no question of it. Murtagh had bested him, and only Galbatorix's mercy, such as it was, had saved him. "Aragorn, do not dwell on it," said Arya. "You had no reason to suspect he would try to kill you, nor were you trying to kill him. If you had, the fight would have gone differently, and Murtagh would never have had the chance to attack you as he did." Doubtful, Aragorn glanced over to where she stood by the edge of the pool of light, along with Elva and Saphira. Then Saphira said,
"If he wishes to rip out your throat, then cut his hamstrings and make sure that he cannot do it again."
Aragorn nodded, acknowledging what they had said. He and Murtagh separated and again took up their positions opposite each other, while Galbatorix looked on approvingly. This time, Aragorn was the first to attack. They fought for what felt like hours. Murtagh did not attempt any more killing blows, whereas Aragorn, to his satisfaction, succeeded in touching Murtagh on the collarbone, although he stopped the blow before Galbatorix saw fit to do so himself. Murtagh looked unsettled by the touch, and Aragorn allowed himself a brief smile at Murtagh's reaction. There were other blows that they failed to block as well. For all their speed and skill, neither he nor Murtagh was infallible. And without an easy means to end the fight, it was inevitable that they would make mistakes, and that those mistakes would result in injuries. The first wound was a cut Murtagh gave Aragorn on his right thigh, in the gap between the edge of his hauberk and the upper part of his greave. It was a shallow cut, but exceedingly painful, and every time Aragorn put his weight on the leg, blood surged from the wound. The second wound was also Aragorn's, a gash above one eyebrow, after Murtagh landed a blow upon his helm and the edge of it drove into his flesh. Of the two wounds, Aragorn found the second by far the most aggravating, because blood kept dripping into his eye, obscuring his vision. Then Aragorn caught Murtagh on the wrist again, and this time sliced all the way through the cuff of his gauntlet, the sleeve of his tunic, and a thin layer of skin, to the bone beneath. He failed to sever any muscles, but the wound seemed to pain Murtagh a great deal, and the blood that seeped into his gauntlet caused him to lose his grip at least twice. Aragorn took a nick to his right calf, and then, when Murtagh was still recovering from a failed attack, he moved around to Murtagh's shield side and brought down Brisinger as hard as he could upon the middle of Murtagh's left greave, denting the steel. Murtagh howled and jumped back on one leg. Aragorn followed, swinging Brisinger in an attempt to batter him to the floor. Despite his injury, Murtagh was able to defend himself, and a few seconds later, Aragorn was the one who was hard-pressed to remain on his feet. For a time, their shields resisted the relentless pounding. Galbatorix, Aragorn was pleased to realize, had left intact the enchantments upon their swords and armor. But then the spells on Aragorn's shield gave way, as did those on Murtag's, which was apparent from the chips and splinters that flew every time their swords landed. Soon afterward, Aragorn cracked Murtag's shield with a particularly heavy blow. His victory was short-lived, for Murtag grasped Zarok with both hands and struck at Aragorn's own shield twice in quick succession, and it split as well, leaving them equally matched once again. As they fought, the stone beneath them grew slippery with smears and splashes of blood, and it became increasingly difficult to keep their footing. The massive presence chamber returned distant echoes of their clashing weapons, like the sounds of a long-forgotten battle, and it felt as if they were the center of all that existed, for theirs was the only light, and the two of them were alone within its compass. And all the while, Galbatorix and Shrukin continued to watch from within the bordering shadows. Without their shields, Aragorn found it easier to land blows upon Murtag, mainly upon his arms and legs, even as it was easier for Murtag to do the same to him. For the most part, their armor protected them from cuts, but it did not protect them from lumps and bruises, of which they accrued many. In spite of the wounds he gave Murtag, Aragorn began to suspect that of the two of them, Murtag was the better swordsman. Not by much, but enough that Aragorn was never really able to gain the upper hand. If the course of their duel continued, Murtag would end up wearing him down until he was too hurt or too tired to go on, an outcome that seemed to be fast approaching. With every step, Aragorn could feel the blood gushing over his knee from the cut on his thigh, and with every moment that passed, it became harder to defend himself. He had to end the duel now, or else he would be unable to take on Galbatorix afterward. As it was, he doubted he would pose much of a challenge to the king, but he had to try. If nothing else, he had to try. The heart of the problem, he realized, was that Murtag's reasons for fighting were a mystery to him, and unless he could figure them out, Murtag would continue to catch him by surprise. Aragorn thought back to what Gleda had told him outside Drasleona.
You must learn to see what you are looking at.
And also,
the way of the warrior is the way of knowing.
So he looked at Murtag. He looked at him with the same intensity with which he had gazed upon Arya during their sparring sessions, the same intensity with which he had studied himself during his long night of introspection on Vroengard. By it, he sought to decipher the hidden language of Murtag's body. He met with some success. It was clear that Murtag was drawn and hard-worn, and his shoulders were hunched in a way that spoke of deep-rooted anger, or perhaps it was fear. And then there was his ruthlessness, hardly a new characteristic, but newly applied to Aragorn. Those things Aragorn discerned, along with other subtler details, and then he strove to reconcile them with what he knew of Murtag from days past, with his friendship and his loyalty, and his resentment of Galbatorix's control. It took a few seconds, seconds filled with strained breathing and a pair of awkward blows that gained him another bruise on his elbow, until the truth came to Aragorn. It seemed so obvious when it did. There had to be something in Murtag's life, something their duel would affect, that was so important to Murtag, he felt compelled to win by any means necessary, even if that meant killing his own half-brother. Whatever that something was, and Aragorn had his suspicions, some more disturbing than others, it meant that Murtag would never give up. It meant that Murtag would fight like a cornered animal until his very last breath. And it meant Aragorn would never be able to defeat him through conventional measures, for the duel did not mean as much to him as it did to Murtag. For Aragorn, the duel was a convenient distraction, and he cared little who won or lost, as long as he was still able to face Galbatorix afterward. But for Murtag, the duel was of far more significance, and from experience, Aragorn knew that determination such as his was costly, if not impossible, to overcome by force alone. The question, then, was how to stop a man who was resolved to persist and prevail in spite of whatever obstacles barred his way. It was an unsolvable conundrum, until at last Aragorn realized that the only way to best Murtagh was to give him what he wanted. In order to achieve his own desire, Aragorn would have to accept defeat. But not entirely. He could not leave Murtagh free to carry out Galbatorix's bidding. Aragorn would grant Murtagh his victory, and then he would take his own. As she listened to his thoughts, Saphira's anguish and concern grew more pronounced, and she said,
"No, Aragorn, there must be another way."
"Then tell me what it is," he said, "for I cannot see it." She snarled, and Thorn growled back at her from across the pool of light. "Choose wisely," said Arya, and Aragorn understood her meaning. Murtagh rushed at him, and their blades met with a clamorous ring, and then they disengaged and paused a moment to gather their strength. As they started toward each other once again, Aragorn sidled to Murtagh's right, while at the same time allowing his sword arm to drift away from the side of his body, as if through exhaustion or carelessness. It was a slight motion, but he knew that Murtagh would notice, and that he would attempt to exploit the opening he had provided. At that moment, Aragorn felt nothing. He still registered the pain from his wounds, but at a remove, as if the sensations were not his own. His mind was like a pool of deep water on a breathless day, flat and motionless, and yet filled with the reflection of those things around it. What he saw, he registered without conscious thought. The need for that had passed. He understood all that was before him, and further contemplation would only hamper him. As Aragorn expected, Murtagh lunged toward him, stabbing at the middle of his belly. When the time was ripe, Aragorn turned. He moved neither fast nor slow, but at just the right speed the situation required. The motion felt preordained, as if it were the only action he could have taken. Instead of striking him in the gut, as Murtagh had intended, Zarok struck Aragorn in the muscles along his right side, directly below his ribcage. The impact felt like a hammer blow, and there was a steely slither as Zarok slid past the broken links of his mail and into his flesh. The coldness of the metal made Aragorn gasp more than the pain itself. Behind him, the tip of the blade tugged at his hauberk as it emerged from his body. Murtagh stared, seemingly taken aback. Before Murtagh could recover, Aragorn drew back his arm and thrust Brisinger into Murtagh's abdomen, close to his navel, a far worse wound than the one Aragorn had just received. Murtagh's face went slack. His mouth opened as if he were going to speak, and he fell to his knees, still clutching Zarok. Off to the side, Thorn roared. Aragorn pulled Brisinger free, then stepped back, and grimaced in a soundless howl as Zarok slid out of his body. There was a clatter as Murtagh released Zarok, and it dropped to the floor. Then he wrapped his arms around his waist, doubled over, and pressed his head against the polished stone. Now Aragorn was the one to stare, hot blood dripping into one eye. From on his throne, Galbatorix said, "Nayana!" And dozens of lanterns throughout the chamber sprang to life, once again revealing the pillars and carvings along the walls, and the block of stone where Nasawada stood chained. Aragorn staggered over to Murtagh and knelt next to him.
"And to Aragorn goes the victory," said the king, his sonorous voice filling the great hall. Murtagh looked up at Aragorn, his sweat-beaded face contorted with pain.
"You couldn't just let me win, could you?"
he growled in an undertone.
"You can't beat Galbatorix, but you still had to prove that you are better than me. Argh!"
He shuddered and began to rock back and forth upon his shins. Aragorn put a hand on his shoulder.
"Why?"
he asked, knowing that Murtagh would understand the question. The answer came as a barely audible whisper.
because I hoped to gain his favor so that I could save her.
Tears blurred Murtagh's eyes, and he looked away. At that, Aragorn realized that Murtagh had been telling the truth earlier, and he felt a sense of dismay. Another moment passed, and Aragorn was aware of Galbatorix watching them with keen interest. Then Murtagh said,
"You tricked me. It was the only way."
Murtagh grunted,
"That was always the difference between you and me."
He eyed Aragorn.
"You were willing to sacrifice yourself.
I wasn't. Not then.
But now you are. I'm not the person I once was. I have Thorn now, and..."
Murtagh hesitated. Then his shoulders rose and fell in a tiny shrug.
"I'm not fighting for myself anymore. It makes a difference."
He took a shallow breath and winced.
"I used to think you were a fool to keep risking your life as you have. I know better now. I understand why. I understand."
His eyes widened and his grimace relaxed, as if his pain was forgotten, and an inner light seemed to illuminate his features.
"I understand. We understand,"
he whispered. And Thorn uttered a strange sound that was half whimper and half growl. Galbatorix stirred on his throne, as if uneasy, and in a harsh voice he said,
"Enough of this talk. Your duel is over, and Aragorn has won. Now the time has arrived for our guests to bend their knees and give to me their oaths of fealty. Come closer, the both of you, and I shall heal your wounds. And then we shall proceed."
Aragorn started to stand, but Murtagh grabbed his forearm, stopping him.
"Now," said Galbatorix, his heavy brows drawing together, "or I will leave you to suffer from your wounds until we have finished."
"Ready yourself,"
Murtagh mouthed to Aragorn. Aragorn hesitated, not sure what to expect. Then he nodded and warned Arya, Saphira, Glaedah, and the other Eldonari. Then Murtagh pushed Aragorn aside, and he rose up on his knees, still clutching his belly. He looked at Galbatorix, and he shouted the word. Galbatorix recoiled and lifted a hand as if to shield himself. Still shouting, Murtagh voiced other words in the ancient language, speaking too quickly for Aragorn to understand the purpose of the spell. The air around Galbatorix flashed red and black, and for an instant his body appeared to be wreathed in flames. There was a sound like that of a high summer wind stirring the branches of an evergreen forest. Then Aragorn heard a series of thin shrieks as 12 orbs of light appeared around Galbatorix's head and fled outward from him and passed through the walls of the chamber, and thus vanished. They looked like spirits, but Aragorn saw them for such a brief span he could not be certain. Thorn spun around as fast as a cat whose tail has been stepped on, and he pounced on Shrukan's immense neck. The black dragon bellowed and scrambled backward, shaking his head in an attempt to throw Thorn off. The noise of his growls was painfully loud, and the floor shook from the weight of the two dragons. On the steps of the dais, the two children screamed and covered their ears with their hands. Aragorn saw Arya, Elva, and Saphira lurch forward, no longer bound by Galbatorix's magic. Dalthdaert in hand, Arya started toward the throne, while Saphira loped toward where Thorn clung to Shrukan. Meanwhile, Elva put her hand to her mouth and seemed to say something to herself, but what it was, Aragorn could not hear over the sound of the dragons. Fist-sized drops of blood rained down around them and lay smoking on the stone. Aragorn rose from where Murtagh had pushed him, and he followed Arya toward the throne. Then Galbatorix spoke the name of the ancient language, along with the word letter. Invisible bonds seized hold of Aragorn's limbs, and throughout the chamber, silence fell, as the king's magic restrained everyone, even Shrukan. Rage and frustration boiled within Aragorn. They had been so close to striking at the king, and still they were helpless before his spells. "Get him!" he shouted, both with his mind and his tongue.
They had already tried to attack Galbatorix and Shrukan. The king would kill the two children, whether or not they continued. The only path left to Aragorn and those with him, the only hope of victory that yet remained, was to break past Galbatorix's mental barriers and seize control of his thoughts. Along with Saphira and Arya and the Eldunari they had brought with them, Aragorn stabbed outward with his consciousness toward the king, pouring all his hate, anger, and pain into the single burning ray that he drove into the center of Galbatorix's being. For an instant, Aragorn felt the king's mind, a terrible, shadow-ridden vista swept with bitter cold and searing heat, ruled by bars of iron, hard and unyielding, which portioned off areas of his consciousness. Then the dragons under Galbatorix's command, the mad, howling, grief-stricken dragons, attacked Aragorn's mind and forced him to withdraw within himself to avoid being torn to pieces. Behind him, Aragorn heard Elva start to say something, but she had barely uttered a sound when Galbatorix said,
"Thane!"
And she stopped with a choked gurgle.
"I stripped him of his wards!" shouted Murtagh. "He's..."
Whatever Galbatorix said, it was too fast and too low for Aragorn to catch. But Murtagh ceased speaking, and a moment later, Aragorn heard him fall to the floor with the tinkle of mail and the sharp clink of his helm striking stone.
"I have plenty of wards," said Galbatorix, his hawk-like face dark with fury. "You cannot harm me."
He rose from his seat and strode down the steps of the dais toward Aragorn, his cape billowing around him and his sword Vranger white and deathly in his hand. In the brief time he had, Aragorn tried to capture the mind of at least one of the dragons battering at his consciousness, but there were too many, and his attempt left him scrambling to repel the horde of Eldunari before they completely subjugated his thoughts. Galbatorix stopped a foot in front of him and glared at him, a thick, forked vein prominent on his brow, the muscles of his heavy jaw knotting.
"Think you to challenge me, boy?" he growled, fairly spitting with rage. "Think you to be my equal? That you could lay me low and steal my throne?"
The cords in Galbatorix's neck stood out like a skein of twisted rope. He plucked at the edge of his cape.
"I cut this mantle from the wings of Belgabad himself, and my gloves too."
He lifted Vranger and held its bleak blade before Aragorn's eyes.
"I took this sword from Vrail's hand, and I took this crown from the head of the mewling wretch who wore it before me. And yet you think to outwit me? Me? You come to my castle, and you kill my men, and you act as if you are better than I, as if you are more noble or virtuous."
Aragorn's head rang, and a constellation of throbbing, swirling, crimson motes appeared before his eyes as Galbatorix struck him on the cheek with Vranger's pommel, tearing his skin.
"You need to be taught a lesson in humility, boy," said Galbatorix, moving closer,
until his gleaming eyes were mere inches from Aragorn's. He struck Aragorn on the other cheek, and for a second all Aragorn could see was a black immensity littered with flashing lights.
"I shall enjoy having you in my service," said Galbatorix.
In a lower voice he said,
"Ganga."
And the pressure from the Eldunari assailing Aragorn's mind vanished, leaving him free to think as he would. But not so the others, as he could see from the strain on their faces. Then a blade of thought, honed to an infinitesimal point, pierced Aragorn's consciousness and sheathed itself in the marrow of his being. The blade twisted, and like a cockle burr lodged within a bat of felt, it tore at the fabric of his mind, seeking to destroy his will, his identity, his very awareness. It was an attack unlike any Aragorn had experienced. He shrank from it, and concentrated upon a single thought, revenge, as he struggled to protect himself. Through their contact, he could feel Galbatorix's emotions, anger mainly, but also a savage joy at being able to hurt Aragorn and watch him writhe in discomfort. The reason Aragorn realized that Galbatorix was so good at breaking the minds of his enemies was because it gave him a perverse pleasure. The blade dug deeper into Aragorn's being, and he howled, unable to help himself. Galbatorix smiled, the edges of his teeth translucent like fired clay. Defense alone was no way to win a fight, and so despite the searing pain, Aragorn forced himself to attack Galbatorix in return. He dove into the king's consciousness and grasped at his razor-sharp thoughts, trying to pin them in place and prevent the king from moving or thinking without his approval. Galbatorix made no attempt to guard himself, however. His cruel smile widened, and he twisted the blade in Aragorn's mind even further. It felt to Aragorn as if a nest of briars were ripping him apart from the inside. A scream racked his throat, and he went limp in the grip of Galbatorix's spell.
"Submit," said the king.
He grabbed Aragorn's chin with fingers of steel.
"Submit."
The blade twisted yet again, and Aragorn screamed until his voice gave out. The king's probing thoughts closed in around Aragorn's consciousness, restricting him to an ever smaller part of his mind, until all that was left to him was a small, bright nub, overshadowed by the looming weight of Galbatorix's presence.
"Submit,"
the king whispered, almost lovingly. "You have nowhere to go, nowhere to hide. This life is at an end for you, Aragorn Shadeslayer. But a new one awaits. Submit, and all shall be forgiven." Tears distorted Aragorn's vision as he stared into the featureless abyss of Galbatorix's pupils. They had lost. He had lost. The knowledge was more painful than any of the wounds he had received. 100 years worth of striving, all for naught. Saphira, Elva, Arya, the Eldunari, none of them could overcome Galbatorix. He was too strong, too knowledgeable. Garrow and Brom and Oromis had all died in vain, as had the many warriors of different races who had laid down their lives in the course of fighting the Empire. The tears spilled from Aragorn's eyes.
"Submit,"
whispered the king, and his grip tightened. More than anything, it was the injustice of the situation that Aragorn hated. It seemed wrong, on a fundamental level, that so many had suffered and died in pursuit of a hopeless goal. It seemed wrong that Galbatorix alone should be the cause of so much misery, and it seemed wrong that he should escape punishment for his misdeeds. "Why?" Aragorn asked himself. He remembered then the vision the oldest of the Eldunari, Valdur, had shown him and Saphira, where the dreams of starlings were equal to the concerns of kings.
"Submit!"
shouted Galbatorix, and his mind bore down on Aragorn with even greater force, as splinters of ice and fire lanced through him from every direction. Aragorn cried out, and in his desperation he reached for Saphira and the Eldunari, their minds besieged by the crazed dragons of Galbatorix's command, and without intending to, he drew from their stores of energy, and with that energy, he cast a spell. It was a spell without words, for Galbatorix's magic would not allow otherwise, and no words could have described what Aragorn wanted, nor what he felt. A library of books would have been insufficient to the task. His was a spell of instinct and emotion. Language could not contain it. What he wanted was both simple and complex. He wanted Galbatorix to understand. To understand the wrongness of his actions. The spell was not an attack. It was an attempt to communicate. If Aragorn was going to spend the rest of his life as a slave to the king, then he wanted Galbatorix to comprehend what he had done fully and completely. As the magic took effect, Aragorn felt Umaroth and the Eldunari turn their attention to his spell, fighting to ignore Galbatorix's dragons. 100 years of inconsolable grief and anger welled up within the Eldunari, like a roaring wave, and the dragons melded their minds with Aragorn's and began to alter the spell, deepening it, widening it, and building upon it, until it encompassed far more than he originally intended. Not only would the spell show Galbatorix the wrongness of his actions, now it would also compel him to experience all the feelings, both good and bad, that he had aroused in others since the day he had been born. The spell was beyond any Aragorn could have invented on his own, for it contained more than a single person or a single dragon could conceive of. Each Eldunari contributed to the enchantment, and the sum of their contributions was a spell that extended not only across the whole of Alagaesia, but also back through every moment in time between then and Galbatorix's birth. It was, Aragorn thought, the greatest piece of magic the dragons had ever wrought, and he was their instrument. He was their weapon. The power of the Eldunari rushed through him like a river as wide as an ocean, and he felt a hollow and fragile vessel, as if his skin might tear with the force of the torrent he channeled. If not for Sephira and the other dragons, he would have died in an instant, drained of all strength by the voracious demands of the magic. Around them, the light of the lanterns dimmed, and in his mind, Aragorn seemed to hear the echo of thousands of voices, an unbearable cacophony of pains and joys innumerable, echoing forth from both the present and the past. The lines upon Galbatorix's face deepened, and his eyes began to bulge from their sockets.
"What have you done?" he said,
his voice hollow and strained. He stepped back and put his fists to his temples.
"What have you done?"
With an effort, Aragorn said, "Made you understand?" The king stared at him with an expression of horror. The muscles of his face jumped and twitched, and his whole body began to shake with tremors. Baring his teeth, he growled,
"You will not get the better of me, boy. You will not."
He groaned and staggered. And all at once, the spell holding Aragorn vanished, and he fell to the floor. Even as Elva, Arya, Sephira, Thorn, Shrukan, and the two children began to move again as well. A deafening roar from Shrukan filled the chamber, and the huge black dragon shook Thorn off his neck, sending the red dragon flying halfway across the room. Thorn landed on his left side, and the bones in his wing broke with a loud snap.
"I shall not give in," said Galbatorix.
Behind the king, Aragorn saw Arya, who was closer to the throne than Aragorn, hesitate and look back at them. Then she sprinted past the dais and ran with Sephira towards Shrukan. Thorn struggled to his feet and followed. His face contorted like a madman's, Galbatorix strode toward Aragorn and swung Vranga at him. Aragorn rolled to the side and heard the sword strike the stone by his head. He kept rolling for another few feet, then pushed himself into a standing position.